Hello to all my fellow 101 History Podcast listeners out there. It certainly has been a good while since I was on the air last with you guys. Seems like an eternity, but I know for a fact that since the time I was on the air last with you guys until now, I had been preparing long and hard as to deciding how much further to go. In other words, was I going to need two more episodes to finish this book topic podcast series on the frozen water trade, or was I going to be able to come on the air and announce to you all that we would now be in the epilogue? Well, here's the news, or I should say, here's the deal. This podcast segment episode to Gavin Waitman's The Frozen Water Trade, How Ice from New England Lakes Kept the World Cool, this episode is, in fact, the epilogue to this series. It has been quite an amazing journey, but I think we will be surprised to know how the journey ends. Sometimes, you know, we have to think to ourselves, just how exactly are things going to end? Is there going to be a decent ending, or is it going to be an ending that is going to bring more news that is the opposite? You know, is it going to bring news that is both exciting and sad? Well, if you ask me, the epilogue to this episode would be one that would bring news that is sad and news that is exciting to a degree, but yet news that will actually be somewhat of a shocker. Because I'm sure many of you are probably thinking to yourselves, oh, I'm sure there's got to be memorials and plaques honoring Frederick Tudor for all of his accomplishments that he had done, most notably around Fresh Pond and Wenham Lake. I'm sure many of you are thinking there have to be more memorials honoring this gentleman for all that he's accomplished. Well, I think it is fair to say that there are museums in Massachusetts that that have talked about Mr. Tudor, and they should. But at the same time, we just have to wonder, if you go to a lake or a pond like Wenham Lake or Fresh Pond, do they actually have memorials on site recognizing the fact that Frederick Tudor not only proved the skeptics wrong, most notably within the inner circle of the Brahmin elite, but that he was in fact an individual whom did something that was unthinkable, and yet proved the skeptics wrong, most notably being able to ship a frozen commodity that still remained intact 16,000 miles across the ocean to Calcutta, India. You know, we would think that there would have to be memorials honoring a contribution of that magnitude. You know, that's what we would have to assume. But in order to be able to prove if, in fact, there are memorials around these bodies of water, we have to actually dig into the research to find if, in fact, this is the real truth. I mean, in other words, yes, based upon what I've read, and I know it's true, and all of us have learned this, that yes, there was such a thing as a frozen water trade. But the question we have to find out is, when you encounter lakes or rivers or ponds up in Massachusetts, do they have anything that can tell the public that, hey, a frozen water trade did exist, and ice was cut from these ponds, not only to serve people perhaps nearby, but to actually transport ice from point A to point B, get it on a rail, and then to the wharf, and then for it to be transported as far south as, say, you know, New Orleans or Charleston or Savannah, to places in the Caribbean, and then, of course, 16,000 miles across the ocean into Calcutta, India. So this epilogue will be a unique one where we have some good, some sad, and a little bit of shocking news, to say the least. So let's be prepared to go for our final episode to The Frozen Water Trade by Gavin Waitman. So here we go with our first leadoff question, I should say. Did Special Agent Henry Hall firmly believe that there would never be a shortage of ice in general. Well, if I'm in Henry Hall's shoes, I'm going to have this assumption that there will never be a shortage of ice. And so the answer is yes. For most notably for Special Agent Henry Hall, per his estimate figures, based upon the research findings that he had done, per his estimate figures, 1 square mile of ice, a foot thick, once it got cut, could yield up to 700,000 tons, which meant all smaller size lakes averaging 15 square miles. And how many acres do you all think are in 15 square miles? I didn't know this, but I needed to do the research in order to be able to give you all the exact number. 15 square miles for all smaller size lakes, folks, that's 9,600 acres. So if 1 square mile of ice, a foot thick, if it can, once cut, can yield around 700,000 tons, with meaning that all smaller size lakes averaging around 15 square miles, 9,600 acres, thus had the means, or I should say potential, to supply the entire United States with ice. So these are the findings that Special Agent Henry Hall has done. He's also firmly convinced that America will never experience an ice shortage for as long as he's alive. Well, the irony to it is that given that, how do I say it, Henry Hall has lived long enough to see some ice famines take place. He's lived long enough by now to know that New York's Hudson River, while yes, it has frozen, but it has not frozen solidly over. He has seen where Philadelphia and Washington and Baltimore have experienced an ice famine. Even Boston has. So he's had to come to the realization that when these cities have experienced ice famines or shortages, whom are they going to rely to? They're going to rely upon the Kennebec River region and the various ice companies in Maine. But even in situations like those, perhaps Agent Henry Hall is convinced that the state of Maine, most notably in the Kennebec River region, will always be the savior, the primary savior that can rescue just about any other town or city out of a famine, no matter how severe the famine itself is. Now, during the 1880s, folks, is going to be a first. I don't think it's going to be a first for a good reason, but at the same time, it could be a first for something that has never really come across before until about now. In the 1880s, the first concerns were addressed about the dangers of ice cut from rivers and lakes. Most notably during summertime, where these waters became foul. In other words, filthy, putrid, unsanitary. So these waters became foul with water contaminated by sewage. Most notably in Midwest cities like Chicago, Illinois, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin, rising urban populations. You know, these cities are growing. So health officials in Milwaukee and Chicago decided to ultimately put an end to cutting all ice that lied nearby towns and cities. But most notably, city health officials in Milwaukee and Chicago are saying, hey, look, for those of you who live in these cities or in towns right on the outskirts of these cities, you will no longer be able to cut ice along the presence of the towns because of these health dangers during summertime, given that the waters constantly run afoul. In other words, there's no proper means of sanitation that would keep the public safe. Matter of fact, it wouldn't be until I think around the 1880s that Chicago started actually coming up with better sanitation plans and how to go about managing proper sanitation practices to where sewage issues would not be a recurring problem. I don't know how successful the city was, but you know, we can give them credit for at least trying to lay a proper blueprint foundation. So how did places like Chicago, Illinois, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin adapt after health officials banned cutting ice close to nearby towns? They have to, I mean, they're going to have to adapt somehow. They'll have to somehow reinvent the wheel. Well, they're not going to give up on the ice trade on their end altogether. But cities like Chicago and Milwaukee are going to turn to remote regions of Wisconsin further inland from Lake Michigan. Now, I know many of you are thinking, well, how can Chicago turn to Wisconsin when Chicago is not in Wisconsin? Well, folks, if you look at a map very carefully, Chicago, Illinois is not far from the Illinois-Wisconsin line. You've got a few places west of Chicago and Illinois, most notably Rockford to the west, which is near the Illinois-Wisconsin line, close to places like Whitewater, Delavan, Janesville, Wisconsin. So, you know, if you live in Rockford, you can rely on places further inland from west of Lake Michigan to where you can get sources of ice transported, not only from southwest Wisconsin to Milwaukee, but say southwest Wisconsin into extreme northwest Illinois, and then moving eastward into northeast Illinois, aka Chicago. So basically, Milwaukee and Chicago are going to return to remote regions of Wisconsin further inland from Lake Michigan, where many freshwater lakes lied and had been known to produce strong crops of clear ice. Okay, so this is going to be the, perhaps this should be seen as the saving grace factor, so that an ice company or two that does exist in Chicago won't go completely bankrupt. And the same for Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Now, we forward to the last decade of the 19th century. During the 1890s, many European immigrants were coming to America left and right. And I think it's fair to say even in the post-Civil War era, we had another rise in immigration, most notably with immigrants coming into the Midwest and Northeast. But during the 1890s, many immigrants were making their way into the heart of Midwest towns, villages, and cities. And when I think of cities, here I am thinking of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Chicago, Illinois. So the 1890s produced many European immigrants whom are in need of work during the winter season. Milwaukee and Chicago had multiple ice companies, which is a great thing because that can certainly help garner employment for those whom are wanting to seek a better way of life. And by coming to America, you know, yes, you need to support your family all year round, but if you're struggling to find work during the wintertime, then hey, coming to work at an ice company in Milwaukee or Chicago, that's some very good part-time work that will help you get through the season. However, despite the multiple ice companies in these cities, there were feuds that took place between rival companies that were not for the better, but rather for the worse. The year 1900, okay, we've started a new century, 1900, aka 20th century, two Wisconsin ice companies feuded against one another, being the Pike and North Lake Company and Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company, pardon me. The Pike and North Lake Company obtained ice from two clear inland lakes in the midst of the Milwaukee River being heavily polluted. Wisconsin Company was cutting ice from the river but opposed the new company, placing ads claiming that its ice was to be much more pure, aka cleaner. The Pike Company built large ice houses close to a railroad. But here's a big problem, folks. Pike Company failed to realize until after cutting including storing the ice, that they did not, in fact, own the land. They didn't so much own the land, but they didn't own the land in between the ice houses nor the railroad. Officials from the Pike Company would ultimately learn shortly afterwards that an agent got possession of the land and objected to selling. In other words, Pike Company officials believe that the agent whom got possession of the land was probably working undercover for the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. Well, this is just the beginning of a feud, folks, but here we go with the rest of it, because I'm sure that many of you are just dying to know, how in the world will this feud end? Because the last thing we don't want to hear about is people losing their lives. You know, it wasn't that long ago in 1894 that the United States experienced its worst ever labor strike that still was considered to be the worst one today. It had to do with what I do know about it, and I do need to read this one particular book called The Edge of Anarchy, basically how the railroad barons manipulated the systems to where they were the ones reaping in the profits, and the workers working under them were the ones who were, how do I say it in a very polite way, were getting screwed over, getting mistreated to where they were not getting their fair share of earning a decent wage, knowing how much they were putting in week by week. So the bottom line is that particular situation did sadly result in a fair number of people losing their lives. The last thing anybody now wants is a repeat, given that two ice companies in Wisconsin, rival ice companies, are going at it. And it's involving immigrants whom are in search of a better way of life, but yet need temporary work to get through the winter season. Hang tight for just a moment. I tell you, nothing beats a nice glass of cold water with some ice. I've mentioned that quite a bit from other episodes to this series about how people really felt better back in colonial times, and even in the 19th century, they felt a lot safer when it came to drinking their water with crushed ice, because at one time you didn't drink water. Water was considered unsafe. There was no way to filter out the harmful bacteria, germs. Anybody whom had access to drinking good water were those who had wells. But not everybody could own wells, because only the wealthy could afford to own a well. But anyways, yes, thank heavens that, you know, we do have, thank heavens that a lot of us have access to ice that can help not only keep our beverages cool, but also chill foods that can last longer thanks to modern day conveniences, which should not be taken for granted. But as for the Wisconsin Ice Company and as for the Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company, their employees were primarily that of Polish immigrants, whereas the Pike Company, the good majority of their European immigrant employees were of German background. So we basically have Polish immigrants going against German immigrants. January 1st, 1901, the Pike Company denied use of its harvest right at the same time the Wisconsin Company was about to cut ice. The Pike Company advertised along the Milwaukee River, believe it or not, this is in January 1901, folks. They're advertising along the Milwaukee River a boat excursion ride per vessel, Julius Gall, G-O-L-L. Now, how in the world can you be doing a boat excursion ride in the heart of wintertime? I don't know, but I don't see how it could be done. But yet, I don't know if this is so much for entertainment, folks. But what I do know is that Pike Company is trying to make things very difficult for Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company. So this vessel, Julius Gull, was designed as an icebreaker ship. Okay, so this is nothing luxury, folks. This is a ship that's designed for business purposes, and that is to break ice. But this vessel is ultimately, or I should say, it's doing things that it really shouldn't be doing. It's one thing to break ice per its own territory, but yet the Julius Gull ultimately went about deliberately making its way through Wisconsin Lakes Ice and Cartage Company's territory without company officials' consent, thus destroying her rival's ice supplies. Julius Gull's excursions went on for 6 weeks. Finally, the Wisconsin State Legislature got involved, and the Wisconsin State Legislature enacted a law not long afterwards, being the Overbeck Ice Bill, thus ultimately requiring all ice harvesting companies to pay for the rights to cut ice on Wisconsin's lakes. I did read where the Knickerbocker Ice Company in New York a few years later challenged this legislation, and they ultimately won. You have to wonder to yourself, well, if the New York Knickerbocker Ice Company challenged this and they won, what was the point in even enacting legislation to begin with? But of course, we do have to be reminded that one of the reasons why we have a court system, folks, whether it's a state court, United States Supreme Court, a federal circuit court system, you know, you do have the right to take your case not only to a local level, but as high up as, say, your state Supreme Court to challenge the validity of laws. And of course, you know, it's one thing to put bills into legislation, but you know, judges do have the right to decide whether or not laws are valid, not only at the state level, but even as high up as the national level. So that's where we get checks and balances. Now, come the 1890s into the start of the 20th century, what had become common practices for transporting heavy ice loads? During the 1890s, schooners, being those ships with two or more masts, were taking loads around 1,800 tons of ice via getting towed by steam tug to the ocean. There were also sailing barges, which were less expensive and were heavily used for getting ice to New York, including markets south, being Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. Well, there's not, you know, New York heavily relied on these sailing barges that were prevalent along the Hudson River in the Catskills that ultimately made their way down into New York City to supply the broader population with vast quantities of ice. Now, harvesting rights and ice houses were owned by companies located within cities where the ice got sold. As for employees working for ice companies, representatives, they got sent to check the amounts stored to being shipped. What's unique about Maine's workforce is that the employees working for the ice companies in Maine were primarily locally sourced people. They were heavily local with many employees whom came from the lumber industry. And think about it, folks, lumber industry would be big up there. And is it fair to say that those whom came from the lumber industry would work in the ice industry, say, during winter time? It's because around mid-winter time, that's when the lumber industry's operations pretty much cease to exist. There's no need to be working during winter time. So you have to find work elsewhere. So yes, a majority of Maine's employees in the ice industry during the winter season also work most notably in the lumber industry. So lumbermen were placed in company boarding houses. Ice companies It turns out, folks, we're using local horses. However, there could be shortages from time to time, and when shortages occurred involving not having enough of a presence of local horses, or I should say, if there wasn't enough of a supply of local horses, what would have been done to have modified the shortages? Well, if there were a shortage of local horses that occurred, then the ice farmers would resort to using their own livestock, being that of horses, for delivering the ice to such places as New York, Baltimore, Washington, and Philadelphia, including Boston, when Boston experienced an ice famine. So, yes, if you're an ice farmer and you know you don't have any local horses that can be sold out to you for transporting operation purposes, you're going to have to take a chance and say, well, I'm going to have to use my own horse. Or if I have a couple of horses, I'm going to have to use them all with the hopes that they will still come back alive. But if not, then yes, I'll have to find a way to buy a new supply of horses. Of course, owning a horse is not cheap. I only know this through people who obviously know others who own a horse. And it's probably fair to say that owning a horse is kind of like the equivalent of taking care of a car. It's an investment that requires the utmost care, 365 days a year, 24/7. I know that my mother owned horses when she was growing up. Matter of fact, she owned two of them, and she's often told me from time to time how much she enjoyed not only just riding the horses but taking care of them. So, you know, if that's something that you know that you would enjoy doing, then you obviously have to know what commitments lie at stake. But if you know that you have what it takes to take on those commitments, then more power to you. Did anyone from Maine during the 19th century's final decade attempt to monopolize the ice trade? I was stunned to find this out, but it is true. That the answer is yes. One particular man, his name was Charles S. Morse, M-O-R-S-E. His family was greatly involved in the ice trade for years. And he went about buying up multiple ice companies, resulting in forming the Consolidated Ice Company, which included assets of up to $10 million. Gosh, it's one thing to merge with another company. It's one thing to maybe buy two or three companies, which is a lot. But when you start buying up multiple companies, say a dozen or more companies, then yes, it's an easy slam dunk for a monopoly to be taking place. It's one thing to have a monopoly, but it also discourages competition. I mean, there's no such thing then as free enterprise and free competition. I've had to be reminded that even the railroad industry was known for monopolizing, and it got so bad to the point where Congress had to come in and enact legislation in the early 20th century when Theodore Roosevelt was president. You know, he became president following William McKinley's assassination. McKinley was shot in Buffalo, New York, at the Pan American Exposition Fair on September 6th of 1901, and ironically, Theodore Roosevelt was in the Adirondack Mountains vacationing. He was hiking Mount Marcy, which is the Adirondack Mountains' highest peak. Mount Marcy's named for William Marcy, who was governor of New York State during the 19th century, and there is a village in New York State called Marcy, New York, on the outskirts of Syracuse, closer to Auburn, around the Finger Lakes country. But anyways, yes, Theodore Roosevelt was alerted by one of his bodyguards as he was hiking Mount Marcy. The bodyguard, one of his security guards journeyed all the way up to the summit of Marcy to tell Teddy Roosevelt that you need to get to Buffalo immediately. or as quickly as possible, because William McKinley has been shot, and we don't know if he's going to live. And sadly, 8 days later, he died on September the 14th of 1901. But long story short of it, Teddy Roosevelt got the nickname of the Trust Buster. In other words, he was breaking up the companies that owned monopolies on just about everything. So he broke up the monopolies on the train industry, and Congress enacted legislation known as the Hepburn Act, which set the standard rates for railroads. In other words, the railroad industry became more heavily regulated versus being deregulated. So it's fair to say that that there was no proper regulation practices for the ICE industry during this time, given now that Mr. Charles S. Morse has now bought up multiple companies, resulting in forming one giant conglomerate company that was established as a result of buying up other multiple companies, being Consolidated ICE Company. And now you wonder why his assets are so high at $10 million. Not trying to get off track, but we just have to be reminded of some other things and how they play into all of this, because just because we hear of one situation where a monopoly incident occurred, it doesn't mean that other monopoly practices were going on during the time in which one particular practice of monopolization occurred. The year 1900 saw Charles S. Morse have a total monopoly in New York City with American Ice Company. You know, his assets, we just learned a minute ago, were up to $10 million. But now that Charles S. Morse has a total monopoly in New York City with American Ice Company, get this, folks. You want to know just how much this is worth in terms of the millions now? The estimate is now to be worth around $60 million. And Morse himself would soon become known as the New York Ice King. My gosh, you know, Frederick Tudor, it's a shame that he wasn't considered the ice baron of his day. And I think he would deserve to have been called that. But Frederick Tudor, folks, he wasn't worth $10 million. He wasn't even worth $60 million. Sure, he made, in a 20-year span, he made $220,000 worth in the Calcutta-India trade with ice, which was very respectable, but it never got anywhere into the high millions. The year 1899 saw Manhattan and Bronx, New York families, get this, they paid about 30 cents per 100 pounds of ice. But come a year later in 1900, Manhattan and Bronx, New York families were now paying 60 cents per 100 pounds. American Ice Company now, folks, is charging a retail value amount of $15.50 a ton, where before it was just only $5.50 per ton of ice. I think it's fair to say that we're seeing a lot of price gouging taking place. We're seeing a lot of manipulation occurring left and right, thanks in part to all of these companies that have been formed under one big conglomerate, and Charles S. Morse having this total monopoly in New York City. He's pretty much put everybody else out of business to where nothing can be regulated. Charles S. Morse's defense. Okay, people are starting to question some stuff now, but what is Charles S. Morse's defense? Well, it was a defense strategy centered around an open winter, or we should say a mild winter, along the Hudson River. And while the New York Times did agree that there had been a mild winter, the New York Times did confirm that there were large reserves left, being just under 1.5 million tons of ice on the Hudson River, including vast supplies in Maine. However, the New York Times viewed American Ice Company as more than just a monopoly, but rather viewing the company as one being as one being in league, or I should say in the same organization with the New York Dock Department to eliminate all competition. Now, why would a dock department care about other companies, or why would a New York, why would a dock department want to create havoc? Well, trading in ice means a lot of things, most notably needing space to unload the cargo at the docks. Okay, if you have the space to unload the cargo at the docks, that's one thing. But we should keep in mind that not everybody is going to have equal room to unload cargo at the docks. And if you don't have enough room to unload all of your cargo at a dock, it's going to lead to a dispute. Not only would it be between one company, but perhaps two companies. Disputes were prevalent between Maine ship owners and New York ice companies over delays in unloading the ice to control of the docks. But the control of the docks onto itself, folks, is what's vital to the ice trade. Many companies had problems with renewing their leases, and that's probably why Charles S. Morse had enough financial power on his end to where he could basically buy up all these other companies that ultimately formed this giant conglomerate, being Consolidated Ice Company and eventually American Ice Company, whose value would be worth around $60 million. So the New York Dock Department, folks, workmen working for this company, this dock company, deliberately damaged bridges and other buildings to where American Ice Company's rivals could simply no longer compete. They basically, they could just be, they could be gone without even being told ahead of time that, hey, you all are no longer in service. But to make matters worse, come May 6, 1900, the New York Times reported that the mayor of New York City was with Mr. Morse, and this pretty much led the New York Times to wonder, what is New York City's mayor doing with Charles S. Morse? Is he behind Mr. Morse's backings? Well, we're going to find that out here. New York City's mayor is Mr. Van Wyck. Well, Mr. Van Wyck was approached by the New York Times, and the New York Times did ask him to give an interview regarding a May 6th article which claimed that he had been at the Columbia Theater with Charles Morse. Well, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Van Wyck himself declined to give an interview. So not long afterwards, American Ice Company books, aka the accounting and auditing records, were sent by someone unknown to the New York Journal. You know, it's easy to think that, you know, nothing will slip by or nothing would get released to someone above without permission or consent. Well, someone unknown was willing to be a whistleblower and was willing to provide evidence to the New York Times that would become very damning or damaging. Let's put it this way. So the findings revealed that Mayor Van Wyck was a top-level shareholder, including 30 other figures from New York officials, judges, and politicians, all tied to Charles Morse. It's like that saying goes, there's a powerful saying, you know, money talks. Let's put it that way. Money, you know, just because you take money in the form of a kickback or a bribe, you think that you might be safe today, and you probably could be, but are you going to be safe tomorrow? Maybe not, because it might just be a matter of time before someone within the inner circle will agree to testify with authorities and testify against you and say, well, I saw that person take some money that was, in my mind, considered to be an improper investment, an improper business dealing. I was told to deliberately inflate the books to say that, well, our company is worth this amount of money when in fact it wasn't. I was threatened. In other words, if I was a whistleblower, I could say that I was told by Mr. Jones and Mr. Smith to deliberately inflate the books, and that if I didn't, not only would my life be in danger, but that of my family. So this is where people can get over their heads and do things that they're not supposed to be doing, thinking that, well, if I receive a kickback or if I receive valuable money that makes me a top-level shareholder, then I will be protected from all sources above. Well, you know, it may work that way for a while, but there will always be someone or a group of people who will turn against you as a means of engaging in proper cooperation with authorities. But also, if it means avoiding a severe jail sentence and getting a lighter sentence, then you should do whatever is necessary to make things easier for authorities conducting their investigation. Well, as for Charles Morse, he did go about leaving the ICE business altogether, but years later, he did go to jail for shady business dealings unrelated to the one involving American Ice Company that he was involved in. So this was someone whom, yes, his family did well in Maine, but maybe he should have stayed put in Maine versus trying to go into New York City. Yeah, he did make a good, on one hand, maybe one could say he did strike it gold, but he struck gold without respecting the boundaries. You know, yes, we can all make it big time, but if we still don't respect our boundaries, then what does that tell us? That we are driven by hunger, ambition, greed, to the point where we're chasing the almighty dollar, and that's all we know, to where eventually it could destroy relationships with other people, not just so much families, but other business people, and it could also tarnish our image. So as for Charles Morse, his undoing was a result of so many other things that ultimately landed him in jail for shady business dealings that were unrelated to his ICE business dealings that did go sour. What became breaking news in 1907? A man named Dr. Daniel D. Jackson, who was a chemist working in New York's Department of Water Supply, Gas, and Electricity, officially declared Hudson River ice unsafe to put into beverages. Man, all this time, people along the Hudson River were feeling good about drinking water that they thought was safe because they put ice in it. 25. Why is the number 25 important here? That's the total number of ice samples which had been gathered along a 150-mile stretch of the Hudson River, where ice harvesting took place. Some ice sample findings were judged to be good, aka safe, whereas half of the samples were found to be contaminated with substances deemed suspicious, like typhoid. Typhoid is, you know, harmful bacteria. You know, we think in today's time, there's a lot of rift between, you know, in the medical profession, where there are doctors whom are convinced that that vaccines had some kind of cause behind children getting autism. And then there have been doctors who have said that vaccines are not responsible for why some children get autism. Well, in the year 1907, or in the early part of the 20th century, from a medical standpoint, there were divisions that existed within the greater medical community as to what was the primary causes behind why the ice was no longer considered to be safe to put into beverages. However, a lot of this was put aside to where many within the medical community did believe that ice was still safe to consume. But public opinion would soon change drastically, where multiple newspaper article findings, and we get this even today, where newspapers sometimes will publish articles to, you know, get a point across, but to also sell it to readers to say, hey, this is what we've found, and this is what you should believe. Well, public opinion was ultimately changed in the early 20th century to where newspaper article findings held that Americans would be better off giving up their addiction to ice, as it was ruining their health, including the food itself stored directly in the ice. Now you're left to wonder, okay, well, if the medical community is telling me that I should give up my addiction to ice, given that it could be ruining my health as well as the food itself that's stored directly in the ice, then how else am I going to go about ensuring that my food is going to be preserved to where it can last longer? I mean, what am I supposed to do? Who's telling the truth? Who isn't? We deal with this today. Except there weren't multiple media outlets in 1907. You know, there were no televisions then. So your primary source of news is the newspaper still. Come the time World War I broke out, what state was the natural ice industry in? This is where I have sad news to report. By the time World War I breaks out, the state of the natural ice industry was one that was simply on the brink of collapse. Given timber, ice houses were frequently destroyed by fires due to sparks from boilers, which had been responsible for producing steam for conveyor belts and trains that ran nearby the sheds. Think about it, folks. These wooden ice house structures, yeah, it's great to be able to store vast quantities of ice that, you know, is insulated, that's going to last and all, but it doesn't take much for sparks to take place because of trains, you know, boilers. You get the right ingredients, you know, it's not just a spark, but if the temperature's right, those sparks can cause fires to spread rapidly to where, if the winds are out of control, how do you put it out? How do you stop it from pretty much from becoming what would be a total disaster, a total loss? What event happened along the Kennebec River June 29th, 1910? 114 years ago, folks. What do you think happened along the Kennebec River come June 29th, 1910? A severe fire broke out in a stable, thus producing high winds, whose presence resulted in out-of-control flames, which burned not just one ice house, but multiple ice houses owned by American Ice Company at Iceboro, whom saw two of her schooners completely gutted by fire. You know, seeing your ice houses get destroyed by out-of-control flames is bad enough. But what about the schooners? I mean, the vessels. How are if your vessels get gutted by fire, then how's the ice going to even be transported? Well, in other words, will the ice even be still intact? Well, on top of losing ice houses to schooners, 40,000 tons of ice totally, folks, was eliminated, wiped out. Total losses, folks, exceeded around $130,000. This fire incident along the Kennebec River from June 29th of 1910 was one that sadly led to Maine ice industry's inability to ever fully recover. This was the sign of the times, folks. This was the fire of 1910 that that damaged the ice industry in Maine. Now, what are cities like Philadelphia, Washington, Baltimore, New York, even Boston, what are they left to do now? How are they going to fend for themselves? Now they've lost their most vital connection. You know, these cities have experienced some ice famines. The Kennebec region never experienced an ice famine, but what they experienced was a natural disaster. A natural disaster, an internal natural disaster. And not only was it the loss of ice houses, but the schooners transporting 40,000 tons of ice and losing $130,000. This puts people out of work. Livelihoods are gone. It's, you just don't recover from this overnight. In the years after World War I, including the Great Depression, were there certain areas within the United States where ice harvesting still remained? Yes, most notably in far remote rural areas confined to the northern United States, most notably northern Maine, northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire. You know, when I think of northern Maine, I think of places like Madawaska, Maine, Houghton, Maine, or Houghton, Maine. These are places in Maine, in northern Maine, that are in the Allegash Mountains areas, well north of Portland, but very close to the Canada line. In case you all would be wondering, so these areas, northern Maine, northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire, that border the Canada line, they would not obtain modern-day electricity technologies to cut their winter ice until come the 1940s and 1950s. Now, the year 1912, being the same year which Royal Mail Steamer, we call it as RMS Titanic, but for those of you who aren't familiar with what RMS would have stood for, it would have meant Royal Mail Steamer or Royal Mail Steamship. RMS Titanic sank, of course, as we know, but it was in the year 1912 that Wenham Lake Ice Company business came to an end. However, a fellow named John C. Kelleher bought Wenham Lake Ice Company by turning it into the Beverly Ice Company to harvest Wenham Lake's ice, but this business venture didn't last very long. So we're now left to wonder what became of Wenham Lake all these years after the ice trade ultimately ended. Well, I can tell you this: Wenham Lake still exists today. What do you think have been Wenham Lake's primary purposes in the years since ice harvesting ended? In 1913, the lake got established as a water reservoir for Salem and Beverly Water Supply Board. The lake, including its shores, folks, are not accessible to the general public, and facilities along the southern end are heavily restricted by high fences and placed under surveillance by cameras. You would think that this is a top secret governmental location for intelligence purposes. It isn't, but we should just be reminded that whatever may have existed 200 some years ago is not, it may exist 200 years later in the present day, being today, but it serves as a different purpose than what it did 200 some years earlier. Like Wenham Lake, Fresh Pond also serves as a reservoir for Cambridge, and it's also fenced off, but primarily as a means to prevent pollution, or I should say runoff. And I have some sad news to report, or shocking news. There are no plaques, no monuments, or no mention whatsoever of Frederick Tudor nor the ice trade. As a matter of fact, when Gavin Waitman was researching this book, he went to Fresh Pond, even though it's fenced off to prevent pollution. he went nearby Fresh Pond, and he saw people walking, jogging, just taking a stroll. He asked a fair number of locals if they knew about Frederick Tudor and the ice trade. Not a soul could tell Gavin Waitman that they had ever even known of Frederick Tudor before. To me, this is a travesty. I don't live in Massachusetts. My goal is to get to Boston in a couple of years from now to visit the Freedom Trail, to visit Lexington, Concord, Bunker Hill. But I can tell you this much, when my wife and I do go, and hopefully we'll be able to go in a couple of years from now, I'm going to be able to tell people up in Massachusetts that I read a book about the water trade, not just the water trade, the frozen water trade, and how when Massachusetts' lakes, rivers, ponds all froze, a guy named Frederick Tudor had not only proven the skeptics wrong, but that he was able to find the means of seeing to it that ice was used and not wasted, and that the ice on New England's lakes, ponds, and rivers were put to good use by being transported to places as far south as Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans, Mobile, where people would kill to have something cold, or a commodity that would keep their food and beverages cold long term. And the same for those living 16,000 miles across the ocean in Calcutta, India. Wouldn't it be great to know that you could visit somewhere and know that, hey, this guy was a native of Boston, and yet he took the time to prove the skeptics wrong, even if it meant doing so from within the inner circle. So for those of you who live in Massachusetts and had not heard of the frozen water trade, now you have. Now you know that there was a guy, a prominent Massachusetts man, whom did something that so many people said was shaky, risky, not even worth pursuing, and yet he outsmarted them all. Folks, this business of the frozen water trade was a practical business. It was a business that thrived. It may not have thrived right away, but it was a business that existed for just shy of 100 years. And yes, refrigeration has been wonderful. By the 1950s, over 50% of the American people, close to 80%, were using refrigerators. But remember, folks, modern-day refrigeration just didn't occur with a light switch. It had been around, and it had been conducted upon many trial and errors. But our modern-day refrigeration isn't that old. But yet, the business before modern-day refrigeration was one that it's a story and it's a practice that has been largely forgotten. Our means of preserving stuff today could not have come without what had taken place beforehand. So yes, we still have ice. But ice did not always come in the form of being in a refrigerator. Well, that concludes it for this podcast episode, and also for this series. It has been an awesome one, and I look forward to being back on the air again with you all next time. And when I'm on the air again next, we will be discussing a new book topic podcast series. So, hey, wherever you all may live, continue to stay safe, and thank you for being such ardent listeners. God bless all of you.